hardness above her heart. I go into the bathroom and turn on the shower, and the cramped stall feels larger to me somehow. The whole world feels bigger now that someone else knows everything, someone who loves me. I understand why Peach Salinger was in such a dark place. Beck knew her. She did not love her. I turn off the shower and tear the curtain aside, but when I try the door, it is stuck. I didn't lock it, and it locks from the inside, and I don't understand. I push the door, but it won't budge. Alarm bells go off, and I try the knob again, but the door is clearly blocked from the outside. I panic. I bang on the door. I call out to love and hurl my body against the door. No answer. She trapped me in here. And she probably invented Roosevelt and our baby and all that empathy just so she could safely get away from me. It worked. Chapter 49. I am a monster now. I live in the white, tacky bathroom and I am a monkey on steroids. I know I can't get out, but still I pound into the door. I use my body and I am bruised. I am blue, I am black, I am swollen. When my ribs won't stop stinging, I use my feet. I kick. I have broken the shower stall and I have torn the lid off the toilet. I have screamed help and it's a shitty motel and someone must hear me. The people below, if there are people below, they don't care. I run the shower and the water and when it's cold it stings my wounds and when it's hot it scalds me. There is no love for me in Little Compton, and I knew this going in, and that's the thought that drives me to my feet, which are streaked with blood. I slam into the door. Bad Joe. Gently, Joseph, Mr. Mooney used to caution me when I was a boy. When there was hope. Was there ever hope? I don't know. Bam! Goes my torso, and that time I think an organ moved. I will not use the shattered glass from that shitty mirror to kill myself. I want to go out with a bang, and I drive my other side into the door. The door is my enemy, stronger, more powerful, always ready for me, always locked, always hard, always no. I breathe. I do cry. There is no baby. I know that now. The Corinthians tell you that love is patient and kind, but love is also smart. She is older, wiser. She was married twice. She knows things. She knows men. She knew how to win my trust, and now she is with the police. I'm stupid. I teach and I teach and I test and I test, and yet I'm the one who never learns. I choose wrong every time. I see my mother in her Nirvana shirt, the one Beck is buried in, and somehow it is there, the way you can do that in a dream, in a nightmare. Bam! I hurl myself into the door and my mother is only betting $5 at the $5 minimum blackjack table in Florida, New Jersey. Does it matter where? She is laughing and she likes 40 and he is laughing and I did this. I came here. I told love all of it and now I don't get to have love and I don't know how to stand. My feet don't work. Bad feet. Bad Joe. Gently, Joseph. I jiggle the handle. I slap the handle. I can't break the handle. I try. I pull. I push. I fall back and hit the toilet and I flush it and I listen to the water go away and come back and I am not like that. I am not coming back from this. I breathe and I see Beck in the ground, smiling, clawing her way out. The Mona Lisa, smiling. Can a skeleton smile? Does it matter? She says to Amy, "Oh my God, I need a drink. That was so crazy. I need to tweet that shit now." She has gone into the woods, and I am here in the bathroom. The ceiling has a yellow stain. I can't reach it. I tried. I am not going to leave the bathroom. I am not going to be a dad. I am going to die in here because I was dumb. I believed her. Don't date an actress, Mr. Mooney said, and love is an actress. I wonder if she recorded me, and I wonder how I sound, and I wonder how long it takes to die, and I liked it better when I was, bam, going into the door, but there's so much pain now, and it's hard to move. My skin is the sky in a storm. Squalls of black and blue and white, and the red is hot, and I know it's the end of the world. I close my eyes. I bleed for Little Compton. I am nobody's father. I am a killer, and I'm going to jail, and there is no love in my life. Not anymore. Will they let me watch The Third Twin and The Mess in prison? Will Mr. Mooney give me advice? Will they let me choose where I see my time? Will they put me in the electric chair and will the food be as bad as it looks and locked up on CNN? Will I work out or get scrawny? Will I be in Wikipedia? Will they give me a nickname in the media? Joe Bro? Taxi Driver? Old Sport? The Professor? Lover Boy? Will there be a trial that drags on for months, and will Dez bury his bricks under his bed and take his Dodgers cap off and shake his head and quiet little D and tell Dateline that I was kinda shady, not a bro? Will Harvey be on IMDb if he's on Deadline talking about how I was never late with rent? Will Calvin cry alone in his bed but laugh about it with other people and use his connection to me as a way to seduce Tinder whores? I cry out, "Help!" I punch the door, my hand bleeds. Will the LAPD send someone on the inside to beat the life out of me? Will my Love Actually Revolutionary Road directorial debut on Funny or Die go viral now that my name will be out there? Will I be famous? Will Officer Nico be on the local news in front of the bullshit coffee art house with his spandex crew in the background, telling them all about running into me here in our drive to the hospital in Fall River last winter? Will the doctor who treated me at the hospital last winter see it all on the news and shake his head in disgust? Or will he not even remember me because of how many patients he sees every day? Because I was just some guy. It's not like I was someone he knew, someone he cared about. I drive my body into the door again and again. I get nowhere. It goes without saying that Milo is, by now, on a jet headed out this way, wearing a Wiano t-shirt and watching an early cut of Boots and Puppies and speculating on how much time needs to pass before he puts the moves on Love. Is he drinking, or is he so fucking happy to have me out of the picture and be the knight in fading pastels that he doesn't even need to drink? Will Dr. Nikki's wife take him back when they let him out of prison? Will he disclose details of our therapy sessions? I charge the door, elbows and ribs, nothing but pain. Love. Will I ever be inside her again? Will Love ever love and trust again? Or will her open heart and her beating vagina be the worst casualties of my capture? The worst loss. I bring my ear to the door. A new sound. I am still. A plastic key card unlocking the door. The door closing. My heart is too loud. Fuck the question. Fuck the police. Fuck Love. I will plow. When this door opens, no other door will close on me ever again, and I stand guard. I prepare. I have my hand on the doorknob. When the cops so much as even start to unlock, I will pull back. I will fight. I will go. I hear them take away the bureau that Love used to keep the door closed, and they are here. This is it. I feel the doorknob start to turn, and I pray to God that he is with me. This is how that happens, how you find God in jail. And I roar, and I yank the door, and it's... Love. I stop. She covers her mouth. "No," she says. "What happened to you?" I swallow. "I fell." "You fell hard, huh?" She steps toward me and kisses my chest. She looks up at me, and I was wrong. I think I smile. I don't know. My face hurts. My body pulsates in different places. "You locked me in."
"I know," she says. "I'm so sorry. I just knew you would try to stop me, and I wanted to make sure you were safe, and well..."
She trails off. And that's when I notice how different she looks. Like Halloween, with painted pink lips and Jennifer Lopez hair pulled back in a high bun. She wears her trench coat, and beneath, a dress with every pastel color in the rainbow smushed together, overlapping in flowers. Then she reaches into her coat, and she is a magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat. It's the mug from the Salinger house. It's bluer than I remember, and I would know it anywhere, and it's dry, and it's in my hands, my freedom, the traces of my urine grainy and visible in the interior. Chapter 50. I wanted to get the fuck out of Little Compton, and I do have a morbid curiosity about Brown University because of Guinevere Beck, and it's so strange to speak openly of these things. Love parks near campus, and it looks like you'd think, like an Ivy League school, an idyllic setting with trees and old buildings. On Thayer Street, the main drag on this campus, there are a few bars, a university bookstore, an Urban Outfitters, and a fucking Starbucks. America is America is America. And we duck into a Greek restaurant that is more New England charm than it is Orthodox baklava. Love orders chicken and salad, and I'm starving.
I feel like I just got out of prison. I order calamari and spanakopita and leg of lamb and moussaka and love laughs. Do you need to order some food with your food? I swat her hand. Watch it, Mom. She does a happy dance and says her mind is blown, and I tell her we have to talk about our baby, but first she wants to tell me how she got the fucking mug. All right, she says. Deep breath, and she begins, so much more articulate than her brother. Her first order of business was to do a drive-by and stake out the Salingers to get their vibe. She then drove all the way to a boutique in Newport for new clothes. I needed a Lily Pulitzer dress, she says. What's that? That pink and green thing I was wearing, she explains. Love then beat it back to Little Compton and parked at the Salinger house and put on big fat Chanel sunglasses and stormed past reporters, past cops. She burst in the Salinger house. She started sobbing. I mean, I guess I do kind of like acting, she admits, but I still don't want to do it professionally. What did they do, I ask? What did you even say? I told them I was Peach's lover, of course, she says. She is proud. Our calamari arrives. She grabs a tentacle, pops it into her perfect little mouth. I did a whole monologue about our secret love and New York and all this stuff about the way she wouldn't let me meet her family or come out for real. And I mean, I went off and told them I knew she didn't kill herself. I knew she'd never kill herself. And if you ask me, it was that fucking titty tease Guinevere Beck. You did not say titty tease. She dips squid into cocktail sauce. Maybe I did, she says. Maybe I didn't. I mean, I was so in it, you know? Jesus, I say. I have yet to eat any calamari, and Love licks her fingers and tells me how amazingly uptight New England puritanical bullshit it was. This is where I am such a Cali girl to the bone, she says. We don't care, you know? We're like, do whatever, chill out, be gay, be straight. I mean, what is the big deal? We're all gonna die anyway, you know? Who wants to spend their precious life hating? I understand now the depth of Love's love for me. I have unlocked some cauldron of confidence inside of her. No longer is she content to sit low in a dark room and watch the monitor. Love is alive, and she feels more connected to me than she does to her brother. Listen to her talk about her scam, and there is not one mention of 40, and she credits me with this newfound freedom here in the Greek restaurant. The rest of our food arrives. We eat it, all of it. Love continues her story. She says she dug deep. Her inspirational performances were Rosalind Russell in Auntie Mame and Goldie Hawn in The First Wives Club. I knew one thing, she said. These people who hate gay people and who essentially hated their own family member for being gay, they don't want to think about her grinding on me. They don't want to think about any of it. I mean, maybe they go to a benefit once a year and tolerate it, but they don't want this fucking preppy lesbo in their house crying over Peach's beautiful body. She drinks her water and continues. She told them to let it go, all of it, because you can't prosecute the dead. She said that Peach was incontrovertibly in love with Guinevere Beck and that Beck for sure killed her. See, she says, the magic of this is that they won't even breathe a word to anyone because they don't want Peach to be gay, let alone be murdered by a gay chick, you know? That's kind of brilliant, I say. She nods. Our baklava arrives. I dig in and give her the first bite. Mmm, she says. And she is happy. You should have seen their faces, Joe. I was like, I just need to go upstairs and be in our bed for a moment. Our bed? She nods. She opens her mouth. I stuff flaky Greek pastry inside of her and I can't wait to fuck her. That's also pretty brilliant. And then, obviously, I knew there was no way any one of them was coming upstairs to see what the preppy lesbo was doing up there, so I went room to room and I found the mug and tucked it into my Kate Spade purse, and then I went downstairs and offered to make a statement to the police about my relationship with Peach. I choke. Holy shit, I say. That's hysterical. Yes, she says. They almost lost it, then helped me leave out the back door and asked if I wouldn't mind going back to my car from the public parking lot. You know, so it can feel like none of this ever happened. Brilliant, I say. But there's one problem. She wipes her cheeks with her napkin.
What's that?
When Boots and Puppies comes out. She rolls her eyes.
You mean when it's dumped on Netflix?
Either way, I say, they're going to recognize you.
Who the fuck cares?
I never said who I was or how I knew Peach, and I can say I am bi or something.
I don't care. The girl is dead and we were secret lovers. What can you ever do about that?
There is no more baklava left, and I get a Google alert and the Salingers are preparing to ask the Little Compton Police Department to stop the investigation for personal family reasons that have come to light. There is light, fluttering Greek guitar on the stereo, and the goblets on all the tables are New England blue. My belly is full. My love is real. We should talk baby stuff, I say. I don't know the first thing.
You seem to know how to make them pretty good.
I know what she wants, and I want it too, and we pay the check and sneak into the bathroom, and it's the strongest sex we've ever had. Outside, we pass the Brown Bookstore, and college kids walk, and we are so lucky to be older. They are all either drunk or nervous, and I can't imagine having homework. I put my arm around Love, and she pulls me tighter. Should we get one of those What to Expect books? I ask. Love says yes, but holds up a finger. Her dad is calling.
Hi, Daddy,
she says, and it hits me. Someday my child will call me and say that. Hi, Daddy. The crosswalk turns white. It's our turn to go, but we don't go. Love trembles.
Daddy?
Daddy, wait, she says.
1 second.
She puts her hand over the phone. She looks like she's had a stroke, and her face is a battlefield. Her muscles spasm. Are you okay?
Joe,
she says.
They found him. They found 40. He's alive.
I hear her dad faintly coming through the phone. Love, love. And now I feel like I'm having a stroke, but I have to fake it or else I'll seem like a psycho, and I grin and pull her into a hug. Yes. We run back to the car. No books for us. No time. 40's alive. Alive. I may as well be back in that bathroom hurling my body at the door. He's alive? How? I picture a couple of shrooming college kids imitating Boyhood and roaming the desert, finding the hot springs. He's alive. I picture one spotting the body, unsure if it was a hallucination or if the body was real. She tells me it's a miracle.
Some girl found him and he's in a hospital in Reno and he's fine.
She smacks her lips.
He's fine. This is so 40, just like the time you disappeared in Russia.
Reno, I say. Love nods.
Apparently this girl found him in the desert. I don't know where. She picked him up. He was passed out, dehydrated, and she brought him to the hospital, and they put him on an IV, and he's gonna be fine.
It's the worst diagnosis in the world. And I am not gonna be fine. I am fucked. I think of my acting manuals. I must not ask questions. Love unlocks the car.
The guy has 9 lives, she says. And I mean, phew.
I can't wait to talk to him, I say.
Well, you will, she says. My dad says he's talking up a storm.
That's crazy, I observe in my peppiest voice.
Right? She asks. I mean, of course he doesn't remember a damn thing about how he got there, and his last memory is at the Bellagio, but, you know, that's my brother.
We drive to the airport. We don't talk about our baby. We just gush over 40. And this is my fault. I did not check for a pulse. I did not finish my job. In spite of everything I've learned from the mug of piss, I didn't put that knowledge into action. I'm like an asshole in a sitcom who learns the same fucking lesson every week, and this is my life. My phone buzzes. It's 40. See you soon, Professor. Chapter 51. It's a long flight to Reno. I pretend to read Mr. Mercedes, and we talk intermittently about the baby, but mostly it's all about 40. Love shares the good news on Facebook and writes back to various worried friends. Love emails with her mom about whether or not he needs rehab. The answer is no. Ha.
I don't mention Roosevelt. It's like our conversation never happened. It is unbearable, the way she smiles about him surviving. The way he sits in a room in Reno, conscious, aware that I am the one who put him there, who left him in the hot water to die. We arrive in Reno, and there is a car waiting for us at the airport, and the driver says it won't be long until we get to the hospital. And I pray for a crash or an earthquake on the inside, and I deserve an Oscar because I'm so good. Love says we shouldn't tell anyone about the baby just yet, and I say okay, and my prayers are unanswered when we reach the fourth floor. The building doesn't crumble or shake, and I can already hear him in the room, loud, cognizant, on the phone. Reese is interested? That's bananas. I smell hand sanitizer and chicken broth as we walk toward his room. Love squeezes my hand.
Yay!
Yay, I say. Dottie steps into the hallway and does a double take.
Lovey,
she says. Love runs to her and they hug, and I stand in the hall trying not to stare into the room where an old man screams, "Help me!" Dottie whistles. I hug Dottie as Love disappears into Forty's room. My heart pounds.
You feel hot, Dottie says. She puts her hand on my forehead. Are you sick?
No, I say. It's just the desert, I guess.
Well, she says, linking her arm through mine, we have to talk. Forty has the most wonderful idea about what we can do with you.
Murder me, feed me alive to dogs, strap me, drown me in a pool in the ocean, tie me up, starve me. Really, I say. What did you two have in mind? And my God, how is he?
Come see for yourself,
she says, and leads me into Forty's room. Music plays and trays of food abound, and Ray must have brought his own chair because he's in a recliner, and Forty sits up in bed laughing with Milo, who sits in the other bed. I walk toward Forty Quinn, and he meets my eyes, and he smiles.
There he is, he says. Good to see you, old sport. Have a seat if you can. Settle in for story hour.
Ray stands, yawns. I don't think I need to hear it again, he says. And whatever the story is, it's bullshit. And Ray would rather leave than go on indulging his son. Dottie takes the recliner, and Love joins Forty in his bed. I sit in a shitty hospital-issued folding chair.
Well, Forty says, the first thing you guys have to understand about me going forward is that I'm a writer.
I might vomit. Okay. Forty takes a pompous breath.
What this means is that writers write. We shut off our phones. We take off. We get lost in the narrative. You guys, I know I have pulled some crazy shit in the past, but that was then. This is now. Now I'm a working writer, which means I didn't want to fucking stay in LA and rest on my laurels and pat myself on the back. I wanted to hunker down in a quiet hotel room and think and do and make.
Dottie moans.
Sweetie, I'm on your side and I love you, but you could have called.
Love.
Mom, enough.
Forty.
And next time I will call. I was just dying to start in on a new script. Because that's how this town is. You're only as good as what you've got coming up.
Milo now with an amen, brother. I might faint.
What were you writing? Love asks.
He looks at me now, intently. He smiles.
Another kidnapping story, he says. I pretty much sold it in the room at Paramount a while back, but they got cold feet. And now that I'm a thing, you know, they want it again. So I promised them I'll have a script soon.
Love is perplexed.
Well, how the hell did you wind up in the desert? Mom says you're starting to remember more, that a girl found you.
My heart pounds. He looks up at the TV.
I went on a walkabout, he says. I needed to do research. Sometimes you just have to get out there and see shit if you want to write about it, you know? If you want to write about the outer reaches of the desert where there's nobody around, you have to see it.
Maybe I could get a nurse to kill him. And why can't anyone ask what we all want to ask? Where's the new script? He can't explain what happened to his computer or his notes because he didn't bring notes and a computer. He brought cash and coke. My brain hurts. My palms sweat. Who found you? He smiles.
That's the thing, old sport, he says. It's all kind of a blur.
1 minute, I'm sitting in the buffet, giving $5,000 to a couple of newlywed kids who look like they can't afford to eat in a real restaurant. Fucking liar. And the next minute, boom, motherfucking liar. I'm in the desert, and this blonde girl... He sighs. He flails. I just got a flash of her. Dottie runs across the room.
What did you see?
A sweatshirt, he says. Dottie pleads with 40.
Try to remember.
But he can't remember anything. All he can see is the girl, her shirt.
And then I woke up here, he says.
Splat. Love kisses his hand.
We need to give her $5,000.
We can't, 40 says. She's gone. The nurses say she took off. She didn't even come in. They found me outside. Dottie starts to cry, and Milo puts an arm around her. Love asks 40 how the staff has been here, and he says, it's not the Ritz, and he looks at me and asks how I've been. I look him dead in the eye. Worried about you, I say.
We were so scared, Dottie says, and she stands.
A nurse appears and says she can come back later when everyone is gone. And Love runs after her, and it's just me and Milo and 40 and Dottie, who is pacing. Worked up, wrung out, hands on hips. Imagine how well I would have done had I had a mother like this. The kind who cares, the kind who is here, no makeup, bags under her eyes from worrying.
Well, remember this, she says. You can't write anything if you're dead, and your father and I need to know where you are.
I'm 35 years old. He says. Where does it end?
Not in a desert,
she says, and now she is sobbing. 40 crumples up a paper towel and throws it at Milo. He points toward the door. Milo obliges.
Come on, Dot, he says. Let's go for a walk.
Joe can stay here with me, right, old sport? 40 offers. I feel myself being murdered, slowly. The way they used to drain the blood out of people. Sure thing, I say. You guys take a break. Dottie kisses her son on the head.
Don't make it so hard for me, she says. I love you. Daddy loves you. Let us love you. Let us be there.
Mom, he says. It was a few days. Milo ushers Dottie out of the room, and when they're gone, I turn to 40. Shut it. He says, first the door, then your mouth. I get up and walk to the door, and I close the door, and I return to my shitty chair. He does not encourage me to sit in the recliner, and he does not suggest I get in the bed. He points to the chair next to the bed. Here, he says. I'm suffering from exhaustion and dehydration, and I don't need to be yelling. I sit in my chair. On the muted television, The Cosby Show begins. 40 opens a drawer in the tray table and pulls out two open bags of M&Ms. He reaches into one for candy. He reaches into the other bag for pills. Fucking 40. He pops a bottle of Veuve. He pours his apple juice onto the floor as if he's in a parking lot, and he pours champagne into his cup. I don't want to be the first to speak, but I can't help it. Is that going to help with your dehydration? No, he says. It won't help with my exhaustion either, but it's fine. I'm not the one with work to do. I look at him. Did you call the cops? He ignores my question. He looks at the TV. He laughs. Demented fucking sicko. I love this episode, he says. You know this one, right? Where Theo wants the fucking shirt, never gets old. He wants that shirt. His fucking know-it-all dad wants him to work for that shirt. And his sister tries to make him the shirt at home, but at the end of the day, the only way to get that fucking shirt is to pony up and buy it. 40,
I say. Maybe we can talk. He snaps and throws an M&M at me. It hits my nose.
You fucker. You left me in the desert in the middle of fucking nowhere.
I'm sorry. I could have died. I know, I'm sorry.
Maybe we can talk?
He pours M&Ms into his mouth.
Maybe you can go fuck yourself.
Did you call the cops?
None of your business, he says.
Look, I say. Obviously, we're both upset. He is exasperated.
Did you seriously just say that we both have reason to be upset?
Just hold on.
Look, psycho, I know you're from a broken home, and I know you came here with no friends and no family and no nothing, but my God, Professor, you are not a fucking retard.
Don't use that word, Forty.
You're right, he says. Professors graduate from college. They work at colleges. You never even went to college.
I seethe. Forty eats another M&M. What the fuck do you want?
Number one rule of Hollywood, he says. Shit I learned when I was an intern at CAA for 2 weeks.
Only Forty would have a 2 week long internship.
Don't burn bridges.
Just tell me what you want.
I want you to listen, he says. You can't burn bridges because LA is not like a hospital. The fucker mopping up this floor, he's not going to be operating on you next month. It doesn't work that way. In this business, people get places and you don't know how they got there, but they get there and then the guy wiping the floor, he's running the studio.
I hate it when he has a point. 40, they're all going to be back any minute, I say. What do you want?
I've always wanted a dog, he says.
Roosevelt.
A white, fluffy dog, but my mom is allergic. That's where the title of Boots and Puppies really comes from. We had this puppy for like a minute, and we loved the shit out of her. We named her Boots, and Mom made us get rid of her because Mom was allergic. Fucking broke love's heart.
Liars lie, and I can't betray love, and families do this. Each person gets to invent a history. A version of the injustices, the pets, the names. I will never know the Quinns the way Milo does. Milo, who is probably sitting in a Quinn sandwich right now.
What are you trying to say? I ask. That I'm a fucking grown-up, he says. A hot shit screenwriter, and I'm my own person making my own buck, so I'm getting a dog. And you know what I'm gonna call that fucking dog?
I know what he's gonna call the fucking dog, and I don't want to say it out loud. But I think of my child. This is what parents do. They sacrifice. You're calling it Professor, I say.
He nods. Professor, he repeats. Prof, for short. Here's the deal, Prof. You are gonna write what I tell you to write. When I tell you to write it.
40. He talks through me.
You are gonna churn out shit like you're the guy in Misery fucking chained to the bed by the fat chick, he says. You will write and I will earn, and if you ever even so much as think about telling my sister what we're doing, you fucking dog, I will put your ass in prison so fast you won't know what hit you.
He barks at me, as if he's the dog. And he's too fucked up from pills and vuv to keep his analogies straight.
And you will be fucking loyal or I will kick your ass. I own you now. The end.
I try to breathe. 40 throws another M&M at me.
I said, did you hear me? He asks.
I look at him.
You expect me to believe you're not going to the cops? I hate cops, he says. It's tedious, and there are so many questions and lawyers.
You could have died out there, and you want to work with me? You expect me to believe that? I shake my head. 40, here's what I expect. I expect to walk out of this room and get clocked and come to in an hour tied up in some fucking basement. He grins.
There it is, he says. That imagination.
I left you in the desert, I say, so don't fucking tell me we're gonna be business partners.
You're not a good killer, he says. Obviously, but you're a hell of a good writer.
The sick fuck eats more M&Ms and proceeds to tell me that I'm worth more alive than dead.
Look, he says, I don't care about any of this shit. I don't care about getting sick and getting better, and I don't care about getting married and having kids and getting healthy.
He breaks, choking. He's back.
All I care about is gold. I want an Oscar. I've wanted one my whole fucking life. You can't buy 'em. I mean, not technically. And I sure as hell didn't come close to getting one for the last 15 years, and now you, motherfucker, you're gonna get me my Oscar.
And he goes back to his Cosbys. He really doesn't care about love, about any of the Hallmark human joys we're programmed to want. Family and holidays, joy. He knows what I am, what I did. And he would still allow me to fuck his sister, but then his sister knows about me too, and she still wants me, and of course she does. Of course he does.
I'd fuck Denise, he says.
And of course he would. Twins. And my child shares his genetic coding, and this is why we have war. Because no gene pool is perfect. A nursing assistant barges in to take 40's vitals, and she is cheery and pretty, and she thinks it's so amazing how 40 has such a big and loving family.
I wish everyone could have what you guys have, she says. It's so sad when people are here and they don't have anybody.
You know what I'd like to do? 40 asks.
The nurse cuffs him, blood pressure, not real cuffs, I wish.
What's that?
She chirps.
I'd like for you, when you have time, to take all these flowers and all these balloons and disperse them to all the people on this floor who have no family around.
She looks at me.
Could you just die? She asks. This family is the best, right? If they're not bringing in sushi for us, then they're showering the whole floor with flowers.
She puts a thermometer in 40's mouth.
I hate to say this, but I wish you could stay with us forever.
Me too, I say. 40 looks at me. The nurse says he has no temperature and he'll be out of here in a jiffy. And Love and Milo and Dottie and Ray return and the party continues. 40 reminds his mother about their plan for me, and she says that they want to start a book club at the pantries.
You'll choose one book a month to spotlight, she says. We can even use you in the signage.
Love squeezes my hand.
I love this idea, she says. Don't you love this?
I love it, 40 says. Dad, do you love it?
Ray nods.
Professor Joe,
he says. Now the Quins are debating what the first book should be, and Love elbows me and says it should be The Easter Parade, and I cringe, and I should not have told her that detail about Amy. I do not want her referencing Amy ever. 40 says it should be Misery, and Ray thinks that's a good idea, and Dottie only ever saw the movie, and Milo says the book and movie are both great, and this is my life now. Or it is until 40's memory miraculously comes back. He could do that to me at any moment, turn me in, take it all away. And I can't kill him, not now that Love knows what I am, not when she could suspect me. He's my new mug of piss, alive and well and wiping his nose. Love may have forgiven me for everything else, but she would never forgive me for hurting her brother. Professor Joe would be a terrible moniker for a serial killer. In the hotel room that night, Love is moody, slamming drawers. I ask her what's wrong. She sits on the bed.
Well, she says, why should I even bother? I mean, do you know what the nurse says really happened?
Fuck, fuck, fuck. No, I say. I thought he can't remember. Love sobs. I hold her. It goes on like this for hours. She says her father told her 40 burned through $100,000 in a few days. Jesus, Love, I don't know what to say. She looks out the window at Reno, which looks like Vegas and yet also looks nothing like Vegas. It's lesser, smaller, worse.
It's never gonna end,
she says. My mom is going to sit there and act like he's clean, and my dad is going to run away grumpy, and I don't know. She wipes her eyes and looks at me. How do you think he even wrote those screenplays if he's so fucked up to the point of winding up in the desert coked out of his mind?
I don't know.
And who is this girl?
I don't know.
Do you think she's even real, or do you think maybe drug dealers fucked him up?
I doubt he owes anybody any money. Love looks out the window.
Michael Motorcycle said he's the kind of guy people just want to hurt.
Michael Motorcycle is in prison, I remind her. You and me, we're going to take care of 40, and... She nods.
Believe me, she says.
She brushes her hand over her belly.
This is saving me.
I look out at the lights and see my future. Arf, arf. And how I will clap for 40 when his movie gets cast, when it goes into production, when he gets nominated, when he wakes us up with a phone call, I did it! And Love and I will dress up to go to the premiere, and we will be the writer's family. I will smile, and I will meet all the people who love my work, and I won't be able to accept their love. I won't be able to tell the story of how I came to write The Mess, or The Third Twin, or the kidnapping story due soon. Love pats my leg.
I'm so tired, she says. My brother, God love him, but sometimes I think he literally drains me.
She undresses. She throws her panties into the empty trash can. She's too tired to fuck me, and I'm too tired to sleep. My career is over. I will live a lie like so many people in L.A. At least there will be truth where it matters, in this bed, in so many beds. And I'll find a way to make myself known someday. I'll be a good dad. I'll raise my kids so they won't be stuck like this. Like so many great writers, I won't be appreciated until after I'm dead, and Love finds a key to a safety deposit box with a letter inside explaining how I came to write all her brother's movies. Eventually, I sleep. Chapter 52. It's true what they say about happiness. If you approach life from a place of gratitude, you're more apt to enjoy things. I am whole. I don't need fame. I never wanted that, and I did not move here because of aspirations. It's enough for me to write and know that I did the best I could. I enjoy my life, our baby. And I love that our baby is a secret. We go to a premiere and meet Jennifer Aniston and Justin Theroux, and I eat guac with them and we talk about Cabo. They are both narrow and kind, and they treat me like an equal, and the whole experience is surreal. The best part of it is what happens when the party ends and Love and I are in bed discussing it all and talking about Jennifer Aniston's hair. I go to Milk Studios and a photographer shoots me for the Professor Joe promotions. They aren't going to use my picture because I don't want to be a public figure. Ray can respect that. But they are going to model the mascot on my likeness. Dottie loves that. The first book will be Portnoy's Complaint. And Love is chopping lettuce and she points the knife at me.
Now that's a good fuck you to that Amy girl, she says. I hope she sees the signs the day they're out.
I have a life partner, the mother of my child. She harasses me to take vitamins and tells me to brush my teeth. She sucks my dick and falls asleep before a cocktail is over and ignores her brother's calls when she just can't deal. I know the code to our alarm system, and I am more comfortable driving in LA all the time. I find that it's easier to start the day by going down a hill than it is going up a hill, and I tell this to Jonah Hill at a party and he laughs and says, "Don't tell that to my fucking date, guy." Love was serious about ditching her acting career, and she is different now. And it's hard to know the source of her power. She glows. She says it's because of me. I say it's her. We decide it's us, the baby. I meet up with Calvin for beers in the old neighborhood that hasn't changed. He and Monica only went out for a few days. He doesn't know what became of her, doesn't care. He is being crushed by debt from his DUI. He is defeated now.
He keeps telling me he was in jail for 28 hours. He's gained a few pounds, and he doesn't check Tinder. He says he might move home. I tell him to get his iPad, and we work together on the ghost food truck outline.
Well, 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 he says, this is good.
It sure is, I tell him. And you know what? Just go for it already.
Joe bro, he says, I feel like I've been kind of a dick.
You weren't a dick.
Well, he says, I got caught up in shit. Anyway, I think we should pitch GFT together.
I drink my beer. I tell him not in a million years. It's your concept, Calvin, I say. You came up with it and you've worked it over a million times and you will be the one to make it happen. He pats me on the back. He wants to know what I think about Delilah disappearing. I think LA is a hard place, Calvin. I think it wishes we would all disappear, and it's more of a miracle when people don't.
Deep,
he says. We watch a commercial for automobile insurance. Calvin says his is crazy expensive because of his DUI. I enjoy the taste of the beer, the music in the bar, Take It to the Limit, the Eagles, melodrama that only sounds good in a bar when someone else puts it on. And when we're done, I drive up to the hills to go home, and I enjoy that too. At home, Love is making veal parmesan.
Babies for the baby, she says. You know, because veal are babies? Oh God, that came out wrong. Sorry, little innocent cows. Tomorrow we'll have old bitter chickens.
She is the one. I hug her and kiss her. She breaks pasta into a pot of boiling water.
How go the books?
They go, I say, and we are happy. I track down Harvey. He's in hospice. I bring him flowers and chocolate cake and Eddie Murphy DVDs, and he thanks me. He asks me if I saw Henderson last night. I get the chills. The nurse says he gets confused like this. I tell him he's gonna be fine. Am I right or am I right? His face contorts. I want to believe it's a smile. I don't know, he says. I'm scared. I sit with him until his ex-wife returns and she hugs me and she cries. When I get home to Love, I cry. Love sends them a TV. She says the TVs in those places are never big enough. Harvey's ex-wife calls. She loves the TV. Harvey does too. I don't go see Dez. Drug dealers can all fuck off. Every Sunday, we drive out to Malibu to see Love's parents. Sometimes 40 is there, and sometimes he isn't. But I see him regularly. Twice a week, we meet at the Taco Bell in Hollywood. Today, I am first. I slide into a booth, and when he arrives, he is visibly fucked up. Let me get you a Coke, I say. He grabs my hands.
Thank you, he says. Old sport, professor, whatever you are, thank you so fucking much for what you did. Do you know how gold this is? I mean, I read what I wrote and I swear, I think being left in the desert is the best fucking thing that ever happened to me.
I get the Coke. He knocks it over. I go for napkins and he stops me.
They have people who do that.
40, help me out here. I haven't seen him this fucked up since Vegas, and I forgot how annoying it is. And at the same time, I want to save him. Love rubs off on me.
I mean, a job's a job, he says. You spill, they wipe.
I look at his swollen face. You don't hate me, do you?
Hate you, he says. How could I hate you? Dude, Amy Adams is gonna do the mess.
Will that name ever leave me? No. Great, I say. Congrats.
It's not for sure, he backtracks, but it looks good. Amy fucking Adams. How could I hate you? I mean, you don't even know the level of ass I am getting. Unpaid pussy, my friend. How could I hate you?
I remember when I thought it would be a terrible thing to be a dog. And now I fetch the chalupas and the hot sauce and the tacos and the gorditas. Woof.
Love wins another award for her charity work, and I write a speech for her. On the way home, she says maybe we could have a winery. After the baby, of course. I can't believe this is my life, where the possibility of periodically stomping on grapes and owning a vineyard is real. I call Mr. Mooney on his birthday and tell him about Love, about meeting Jennifer Aniston and choosing books as Professor Joe. He asks if I'm getting my dick sucked, then tells me he's still in Florida. He has an orange tree, and the oranges look nothing like the ones in New York. They're mottled, he says. Like the jelly beans with the flecks in them. Never mind. I'm boring myself. He sighs. The conversation dwindles, and I go find Love. She's outside in her favorite float, the one with the armrests and drink holders, and she's wearing sunglasses. I jump into the pool and push the raft over. She screams again and falls into the water. She comes up laughing, saltwater kisses. We float. Sam is at it again, she says.
Sam the work bitch?
Yeah, she says. We're getting interns, and she said we have to check to make sure they're not on Pinterest because she says people on Pinterest are all stupid.
She's stupid.
I know, Love says. If you hate her so much, why don't you just fire her? Love rolls over onto her side and reaches out for me. Because I don't hate anyone, she says. I really don't. It's just not worth it. We hear her phone ringing. We hear my phone ringing. Love runs to her phone and she answers. Mom? She says. And then seconds later, she drops her phone. I go to her. She stares at me. She is different. She is frozen. My first concern is the baby, but how could that be? It wasn't the doctor on the phone.
It's 40, she says.
He went to the cops, that fucker, that louse, I'll kill him. What happened? I ask. And then she starts crying. It's primal and terrifying, and whatever that fucker did, he will pay for this. I grab the phone. Dottie, I say, and I try to hug Love. And she's shaking. Her whole body is convulsing, and this cannot be good for our baby. Dottie, are you there?
My boy, she sobs. My boy is dead.
My body goes slack.
40 is dead?
When Love hears me say it, she lets out another scream, and I tell Dottie I have to go, and I don't know if the baby will survive, but I know we will. I hug Love. I hold on to her. I wish I could make it better, but I can't. 40's dead. Chapter 53. 40 didn't overdose on Xanax or Gorditas. He didn't get cancer, and he didn't drown in the salt water of the Pacific, or the chlorinated water of the hotels he loved so much, or the salt water that his parents collected for him. A car hit 40 Quinn while he was crossing the street in Beverly Hills. The girl who hit him wasn't drunk, God is not that trite, and she was driving a Honda Civic. She only just moved here. Her name is Julie Santos. The people in back of her were honking. Angelinos, particularly those on the west side, don't like to wait. Julie Santos says the guy in back of her had been riding her tail and honking. Her roommate told her that it's basically legal to take a left-hand turn after the light turns red because otherwise nobody would ever get anywhere. 40 was sober. There were no drugs in his possession or inside him. He was going to Nate and Al's alone to gorge on corned beef and french fries, according to the waiter who says 40 came in alone a lot over the years. We never knew that, any of us. Julie, who seems like a gentle, unsteady person, the kind who will never get over this accident. She wanted to see the Pretty Woman Hotel, and she knows it's silly, and it's not even called the Reg Bev Wilsh anymore, but she cries. I resist the urge to make a joke about 40 and hookers, how even when he's not blowing money on them, they're in his domain. Good old Julia Roberts. A review of the security footage shows that 40 was jaywalking. Love's teeth chatter. She tells me he got 8 jaywalking tickets. 40 didn't like to wait either. He wanted it now, his career, his Oscar, even the goddamn crosswalk. There will be charges filed against Julie Santos, and she says she's going to move back to Boston. She says she never wants to drive again, and it feels like a bad thing. To move somewhere and kill someone immediately. Nobody can believe it. I can't believe it. I think about Julie Santos a lot. I find her on Facebook and Twitter, and I could start a religion around her, and God does have a sense of humor. Her last name is Saint. I did not pray for this, but I am allowed to rejoice in this. Nobody will ever know about what happened between us in the desert. Nobody will ever know about our Taco Bell deals, his malfeasance. I am in Neiman Marcus, and there are two tailors working on me at once because when you're rich and someone you know dies, you go to Neiman's and you get a new suit. Love sits in a chair with her legs crossed. She isn't crying anymore.
Is it awful if I say you look hot? She asks.
No, I say. You say whatever you need to say. She nods. I ask the tailors to give us a moment, and they oblige, and I go to her, and mirrors surround us, and everywhere I look, I see us. Just us. The third twin is gone. I love you.
I love you too, she says. I promise I'm going to come out of it.
Take your time.
It's just weird.
She stares at her Kleenex.
I don't know how not to worry about him.
I know.
It's like my go-to place, she says. What do? I worry about 40. I mean, it's not even so much about drugs, even though it seems that way. It's about being a twin.
I tell her again to take all the time she needs, and I promise to be here no matter what. And she stops shredding her Kleenex and looks instead at me.
What would I do without you?
Irrelevant, I tell her. I'm not going anywhere. She hugs me and she cries again, and one of the numerous pins in my suit pricks me, and I bury the pain and I savor the pain. He's dead. Julie Santos killed him. After all this time, I finally got a little fucking help from the man upstairs, and I squeeze my girlfriend and I count my blessings. She pats my back. The tailors return and Love dries her eyes.
You really do look hot, she says.
The suit will be ready in time for the funeral. Milo is too sad to write a eulogy, and Ray is in shock, and I am the loyal boyfriend, so I step up. And I don't just jot down some bullshit about his sense of humor and his big fat heart, fuck no. I write the fuck out of this eulogy, and it's right up there with the third twin in my kidnapping script, the one I'll volunteer to finish now that he can't because he's dead. Love and I emerge from the limousine, and the carpet leading into the Beverly Hills Hotel is pink and green. Love says this was their favorite place when they were kids, and they had their Sweet 16 party here, and she is crying again, and I hold her. I've never been, I say.
Well, she says, we stopped coming here a while ago. I don't even know why. We practically grew up in here. They have this soda fountain, and we used to get cheeseburgers, and then we would stay in a villa and sneak out and run around in the garden.
You're adorable, I say, and I mean it. When we first met, I was uncomfortable. I thought all this shit with the palm fronds and the multiple bathrooms mattered. But childhood fucks you up, no matter what it looks like. I see that now. The closer we get to having the baby, the less hostility I feel toward my parents. I don't resent my mom for dumping me at Key Foods anymore, because I found warmth there. Poor 40 couldn't find the warmth in here. This pink and green paradise. This Beverly Hills hotel. Memories are all the same at their core. It's just us trying to keep each other alive. The best parts, anyway. We're all pretending that 40 was a wonderful person, and Love is saying something about Beverly Hills 90210, about Brandon and Brenda Walsh, how they used to call 40 the anti-Brandon. Everyone who's anyone is here. Agents, executives, producers, Joaquin, Walk. And I am the one who Love holds on to. The one who has held it together. The one who will eulogize the man who is like a brother to me. The lights dim. A video begins. A tribute to 40 and The Big Top by Michael Penn plays. The song that closes Boogie Nights. And there are pictures of sober 40 and clips of drunk 40. And there is 40 skiing on the water and skiing on the mountains. And he is laughing and he is a child and then he is an adult and then he is a child again.
life. I cry. It's important that I show emotion. I realize this, but it's also genuine. The song has always moved me. The circus sounds, the